Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 26th of April. Frank Rich is with us the first hour of our program today, one of the best columnists in the whole USA, and we have much to cover with him. Frank is executive producer of the new HBO comedy series Veep, which has premiered now on Sunday evenings on HBO. It follows the day-to-day existence of former Senator Selina Meyer. It's a very funny show starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Frank, of course, has written for a long time. He joined New York Magazine about a year ago as writer-at-large, and each month he focuses on politics and culture. He's a commentator on nymag.com, where he engages in regular dialogues on the news of the week. He was at the New York Times as op-ed columnist for a number of years, the paper's chief drama critic also for a number of years, and he's written a number of books, including Ghostlight, a memoir, The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina. His production work with HBO also includes a documentary on Stephen Sondheim, which I believe will be on the air in 2013. He is a native of Washington, D.C., which I say because I think it will be pertinent to our conversation about Veep. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Frank. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. If any of you have seen Veep, we'd love to hear your comments about it. You can go to our Facebook page as well, which is the Kathleen Dunn Show. He's also written extensively about the money in the presidential race, and particularly Republican billionaires. He says they are buying the ammunition for the battles ahead, and we'll look at the race and a number of other issues. Hello, Frank.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. Nice
to
talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you, and I've had the great privilege of seeing the three first episodes of Veep, which is a very funny show.
Well, thank you. I'm very proud of it. I worked on it as a producer and sort of a sideline, and I'm thrilled that people are enjoying it.
What about the role of the vice presidency? The creator of the show, who happens to be British of all things, says you're entirely at the behest of the president, and yet at any moment you can suddenly become the most powerful person in the whole world.
Well, I think that Armando Iannucci, who created and with some writing partners wrote the show, looked at the idea of the vice president not so much literally, although that obviously is the protagonist of our series, but as almost a metaphor for the sort of powerlessness of most people in Washington. Because here is someone who is, whatever, you know, a heartbeat away from the presidency, but as many who've held the job have said, is it's not worth a pitcher of warm spit, or at least that's the bowdlerized version, or it's standby equipment. Most vice presidents are forgotten unless they become president, and so the show doesn't take the vice presidency that seriously, even though a very serious person, an accomplished person, the character of Selina Meyer that Julia Louis-Dreyfus plays, is in that role. But it's really looking at the whole sort of dysfunction of Washington in general, and the impotency of most people to get anything done, particularly things that the voters might want done.
It must have been quite a tall task to put together a show that really doesn't champion any specific political philosophy. You don't know what their political affiliation is, really, do you?
No, because the point is, it doesn't really make any difference. And this, you know, gets back to my growing up in Washington, covering Washington. Administrations and parties come and go from power, but the sort of underlying pettiness, power plays, silliness at times remain unchanged. Armando Iannucci, the creator of Veep, wrote a movie he was nominated for an Oscar for. It's one thing that led to us doing this show with him in 2009. Called In the Loop, and it was a very, very funny movie. I suspect some of your listeners saw it, about the run-up to the war in Iraq, and it was set both in the British government at 10 Downing Street and at the State Department in Foggy Bottom in Washington. In that movie, the word Iraq is never mentioned, the word Bush is never mentioned, the word Blair is never mentioned, because, again, as in Veep, he feels there's something universal about these political bureaucracies and the people in them. And so I felt In the Loop is the best thing I ever saw in film about the war in Iraq, and yet the word Iraq is never in it.
Hmm.
And in Veep, not only do we never know what party Selina Meyer is in, but we never learn who the President of the United States is.
Right.
So it's interesting, in the response to the show, those who have liked it seem to be across the political spectrum. You know, it got a great review in National Review, for instance, as well as more liberal outlets.
Mm-hmm. She just hopes the president will call her sometime, doesn't she?
She does, and yeah. It isn't going to happen. It's like, as no. One critic said, it's like waiting for Godot.
True. Tell me a little bit more about your growing up in Washington, D.C. I'm a little envious. I would have thought it would be a terribly interesting place to grow up. Was it or not?
Not really.
No?
I mean, it is. Yes, it's very, very interesting. Now, keep in mind, I grew up there. Mainly in the 60s, my formative years in junior high school and high school in particular were in the 60s, and I grew up in a family that was not in politics, which gives you a sort of skewed perspective on it, because I guess it'd be like growing up in Beverly Hills and not being part of the movie industry or the entertainment industry. So you see, it is interesting, but you see through the artificiality of what's presented to the public. I think it informed all my writing, including about politics. For instance, you know, as a kid, you'd see other kids come on high school bus tours to see the White House and the Capitol and Mount Vernon and all the rest of it. But if you lived there, you realized that those in some ways were sets. They were the official view of Washington. They're the scrapbook snapshot view, but the real stuff that went on behind the scenes was a lot messier, often drabber, not so glamorous, and not so idealistic or patriotic. So I think that the difference between what officially happens on stage in Washington and what happens behind the scenes and in the wings and off stage imprinted itself on me at an early age. Also, I was fortunate enough that when I was young, but I do remember it, Kennedy came into office, and
that was
a really exciting time to be in Washington. And as a, I guess, an 11-year-old, I went to the Kennedy inauguration, and he was very, you know, in days, particularly as we know through him, of not much security, he was very much around town. You know, both before he was elected and after he was elected, very different world. The vice president then, Lyndon Johnson, just lived in a residential home. He didn't live in this mansion at the Naval Observatory that the vice president has now. But the other thing about growing up in Washington, and I grew up in the, I began in the suburbs, but my family moved into the city when I was young, is that Washington was, and still is, mainly a black city in terms of the permanent population, or a majority black city, and a black city with not full self-government. When I was growing up, no self-government. It was run like a plantation by the so-called House District Committee, which at that time was mainly white, southern, racist Democrats when they were all still in the Democratic Party. Even now, it's very limited home rule. And so there's a very – so here's this, you know, model – this shrine to democracy, Washington, D.C., and yet democracy doesn't fully flourish and isn't fully practiced there. And I wrote a memoir, actually, about this called Ghostlight, just about my childhood, and gave it a lot of thought. And, you know, so it's interesting to grow up in Washington, but all I wanted to do was get to New York. I was in love with the theater. I enjoyed politics, too, and I was constantly conspiring to get to a less provincial town.
I have to read your memoir. I haven't. Isn't it amazing? Look what's happened to you. You're doing your two loves in a way, politics and theater.
I feel really lucky, and I don't take any of it for granted. But, it you know, after all, I had, as you mentioned, I had a long career as a theater critic, and I've, you know, been writing about politics and the intersection of politics and culture for almost 20 years for New York Magazine now and the Times before it, and I find that work very satisfying. But to actually sort of end up being in the theater too, which is what it feels like to work on a show like Veep and my other work at HBO, is a wonderful sort of exhilarating sideline.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Kennedy. We just had Clint Hill on the show on Monday. I don't know what, or Tuesday, that days go by so fast. And
right.
He was just such, you would really like the book, Frank. It's just, I mean, they're,
I
it's so
read
respectful.
It.
It's just, and he's just a respectful, straightforward man. But I found myself at the end of the book, as I did when I was at the Eternal Flame in Washington last year, just crying and crying. That era just stays with me in a very deep way.
Well, it does me too, and I think it has to anyone who lived through it. In Ghostlight, I talk about the day of the assassination because I remember it so vividly. I was in ninth grade, and by a happenstance, I went to public school, and we had won from a local radio station. My friends and I, by sending a lot of postcards, had won a free DJ to come at a dance. And it was the day of a citywide teachers meeting, so school ended at lunchtime, and I was in the gym with other members of the student council decorating for this dance. And there was no one in the school, no teachers, no other students. And suddenly a janitor comes in with a radio and says, "You're not going to believe this." And, of course, at first we didn't believe it. And then I never forget this. I walked out onto Nebraska Avenue in Northwest Washington where my school was. And, you know, this is the days before the Internet, obviously, before cell phones, before 24/7 television, very primitive media world. But I remember every car was just going slow. There wasn't a traffic jam. It was not near downtown where government was. It was a residential neighborhood, basically, but just time sort of came to a halt. You saw it happen, and then I remember going home, and you couldn't get a dial tone on the phone because there was so much phone traffic. It was really cataclysmic. The only thing that remotely resembles it in my lifetime is 9/11.
Yeah, it was. And Clint was right there. Clint was right with her. He had to talk to Bobby Kennedy on the phone. To tell him what had happened. You'll like the book. When did you write the memoir?
I wrote it about a decade ago. It came out in around 2000.
Right.
And it's if people, I'm not trying to sell my wares, but it is in print and paperback and Kindle and all that.
Oh, good.
From Random House. One other thing I want to say, just speaking about Kennedy and books, part of it was excerpted in the New Yorker, but I think coming out next week is the new Robert Caro volume about Johnson, and a huge chunk of it is maybe the most meticulous recreation of the assassination, and from LBJ's point of view, that's been written.
Oh, we want to get him on the air.
Yeah, I know him a little bit. He's obviously a brilliant journalist and historian and terrific guy.
Yeah. So would you consent to doing an interview about your memoir sometime?
I'd love to.
You would? Okay.
Absolutely. No, I have to say, of everything that I've written, and it's a ton, more than people want to read, it's the book that I'm most proud of and really has, you know, my heart and soul in it. And it's about growing up as a child of divorce and falling in love with the theater and growing up in this crazy town of Washington, which is sort of real and not real at the same time.
Oh, great. All right. Well, we'll talk about it. I'll read it. We'll talk about it later. We're going to take some phone calls,
sure.
But we have a couple clips from the Veep show. And you may want to tell us before we hear this, it's a very short clip when Julia Louis-Dreyfus is asking what the biggest campaign mistakes were that she made. Do you want to set this up for us?
Yes. It's in the car, right?
Yes.
And so Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character of Selena, you learn early on that she had run for president at some point before the series began as a very successful senator from Maryland, but had lost. And now she ended up on the ticket as vice president in this ridiculous job. So this is talking to an aide who she's sort of slightly revisiting her failed presidential campaign. And this is with her longtime trusty, not terribly competent press guy, Mike McClintock, played by a wonderful actor that people have seen in a million movies and TV shows named Matt Walsh.
Hey, Mike. What would you say were the two biggest campaign mistakes that we made?
You look tired a lot in the hat.
I liked the hat. What are you
the
talking
hat
about?
Hurt us. Your head looked weird in the hat. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, it comes down to that, huh? It was the hat.
Yes. By the way, the other voice, the other male voice chiming in saying, I like the hat, is her so-called body man, you know, the personal assistant that is always at the side of a powerful politician with a bag stuffed with lip balm and Purell and anything that glasses, anything that the leader might need, and is very obsequious in that role. The character's name is Gary, is played by a terrific actor named Tony Hale, whom some may remember as Buster from the sitcom Arrested Development.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Frank Rich. We have a lot of politics to talk to him about as well. He's written most recently about the amount of money that is being spent in the presidential race, particularly Republican billionaires who are spending a whole lot of money. And there are a lot of other issues because it's Frank Rich, for heaven's sake. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm particularly interested in hearing from any of you who have seen Veep. I know it's only been one episode, I believe, on Sunday, but some of you saw that. And if you can make a comparison to, I also happen to be a huge, and I'm in season 3 of West Wing again after having seen almost every episode when that show aired. So I find myself comparing the two programs, and I want to ask Frank about that as well. Two phone calls, more with Frank Rich in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Thursday, Zach Walls will be joining us. You'll recall Walls, who delivered this amazingly passionate plea to the Iowa House of Representatives in support of gay marriage. He's written about all of that and growing up with his two moms and his sister. The book is My Two Moms, Lessons of Love, Strength, and What Makes a Family. He is a very dedicated young man, and he's very young as well, student. He's taken some time off to do a lot of justice work. He's been a student at the University of Iowa and plans to be an engineer. He'll be joining us. Frank Rich is with us this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And let's start our calls with Dan in Milwaukee. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Kathleen. Great show. I was wondering if Mr. Rich could make the comparison of Washington, D.C. and Las Vegas. I always think of D.C. as more Sin City. It's just missing the casino. But if you go up to Wall Street, got it.
Yeah, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time in Vegas, although I've been there several times. But absolutely, Vegas is a place, of course, is artificially created in a desert as opposed to Washington, which was artificially created in a swamp. But yes, it is another example of there's one reality for the natives who live there and are there through thick and thin, no matter how many tourists come and go or casinos rise and fall. And I have to say, it's the caller asked a question that hits home with me because I've always been fascinated by Vegas because I think now that you articulate it, there's a kind of symmetry with Washington that I hadn't quite teased out for myself, but I think that's one of the reasons why I'm fascinated by it. And of course, there is some literature and fiction writing and journalism that captures the real Vegas. There's not a lot about Washington in that way. When I wrote Ghostlight and looked for books about Washington that didn't deal with the federal part of Washington and fiction, there was very little. There's a little bit more now, particularly about Black Washington, than a decade ago when I wrote the book. But, you know, except for Ward Just and a couple of others, not much.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dan, for the call. You can join us if you'd like. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email that's come in, Frank, from Roger. Have you seen the new play about Joseph Alsop?
It opened last night after some previews. I have not yet, but we should explain to people who are listening. This is a play by David O'Byrne, who wrote the very well received play Proof several years ago, and it's with John Lithgow, and he's playing Joe Alsop, who was a towering figure in Washington when I was growing up. He was probably the most, or one of the two or three most powerful columnists. His home base was basically the Washington Post. And it was a completely vanished era where people like him and James Reston of the Times and Walter Lippmann of the New York Herald Tribune really could have a big say about government and affairs of state. And Alsop is a fascinating character because he was as fundamentally a liberal and I guess a Democrat, but became completely invested in the most hawkish positions in the Vietnam War, and was a huge supporter of the war to the point that it really tarnished him and kind of provided a sort of a tragic end to his career. He was also a closeted homosexual, which is something I certainly didn't know when I was a kid, and I gather the play goes into this. But I'm very curious to see it because there's a pretty good biography of Alsop I read a few years ago. It's about him and his brother, Stuart Alsop, who was also a columnist by a journalist named Robert Mary. He's an interesting character, and that's a vanished Washington. I mean, no columnist in my lifetime has had the kind of clout that these guys, and they were all guys then, and all white guys, did.
Hmm. What about you? Do you feel that you had a certain amount of clout?
No.
You don't, really?
Well, maybe I think the clout you can have now, and it's whether you're a columnist or you're an essayist or perhaps a blogger or someone with a very active and popular Twitter feed, you can inject ideas into the conversation, you can stimulate debate, and yes, in that sense, I and others do have influence. But it's nothing, and I think this is a good thing that doesn't exist anymore, it's nothing to the extent it used to be for these Washington pundits, you know, and often it was it was too much power for them. You know, a classic example involving the New York Times was that, going back to Kennedy, about when the Bay of Pigs was about to happen, the Times of that period, and its columnist and I guess also bureau chief, James Reston, Scotty Reston, another one of these powerful Alsop-like figures, got wind of it. In those days, someone like that could just call up Kennedy and basically, Kennedy could call up that journalist and say, you know, I don't want that to run because, you know, it's a secret mission and so on. And Reston killed it, and later Kennedy said, "I wish it had run. It would have stopped the invasion and saved me from disaster." Now there are conversations like that between news editors of places like the Times and the Post and the Journal and the White House all the time about, you know, not compromising security operations. But this was something really kind of closeted and weird and anti-journalism and anti-democracy, in my view.
Your recent piece is on money in the presidential race, particularly Republican billionaires' money in the race. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about the Citizens United decision in 2010 and the enormous effect it's having right now, Frank.
Well, one of the things I discovered, yes, the Citizens United decision obviously has had a huge effect, and in terms of liberating corporate giving, corporations are people, as Mitt Romney would have it, and the Supreme Court would have it. But what I found in writing my piece about the so-called sugar daddies, as I term them, is that there are other decisions and other less prominent rulings by federal election authorities. There's something called, I think, the Speak Now decision, which we have a sidebar in New York Magazine with my piece to discuss, which have also had a huge impact, and a huge impact not just on corporations, but on private individuals. And what point I make in my piece is, right after Citizens United, we thought, oh, well, you know, everyone thought Exxon will buy this election or General Electric or whatever, and heaven knows these Fortune 500 companies are, as you know, remain big players. But there's a slight checks and balances on them because they do have to answer as publicly traded companies to shareholders. They do care a bit about public opinion. And so, and they often give to both parties, maybe somewhat unequally, but they want to cover their bets no matter who is in power. So in that sense, egregious as it is, there's some limits on them, and they have to be publicly known. By contrast, the contributions have to be publicly known. By contrast, you have very wealthy individuals, and I define sugar daddies for the purpose of this piece, of people who have already, even as primary season is still not officially over, given a $1 million or more apiece to politics during the cycle, private individuals or private companies in that they control, giving tons of money to the so-called public loophole that was created not by Citizens United, but in other ways, the so-called public welfare fronts, like an organization called Crossroads GPS, started by Karl Rove, where they can give unlimited amounts and they can keep their name secret. So when we have a sidebar also with my piece listing the 25 main sugar daddies on the right that we know so far, but there may be others we'll never know who they are because they can hide behind these in my view, bogus social welfare organizations, which actually are completely involved in running buying partisan advertising and flooding the zone with it. So what's also interesting about these sugar daddies is, unlike corporations, they don't even have to pretend to care about their shareholders or public opinion. They have very specific interests. They have small focused businesses, whether it be in selling, in my view, dubious health products, or in nuclear waste sites, or many other businesses, the gambling business. Sheldon Adelson, who's somewhat well known as an example of that, and they can do all this with impunity. And my feeling is, once if their team gets into office, they'll collect in terms of fighting successfully, helping to castrate regulatory bureaucracies and agencies in Washington, are getting their apparatchiks appointed to them or getting them defunded or whatever. So it's a real plutocratic disaster for America, in my humble view.
And we know, don't we, from studies that indeed they do collect.
Of course they do, and that's been true dating back to the era that this most resembles, the Gilded Age, and the guys who then were inventing trust and eliminating competition with little, few breaks put on by the government. And indeed, Teddy Roosevelt, a great reformer, had to go after them. But he had to fight these vested interests. And the question now is, even if Obama gets in, and there's a good chance he might get in spite of this, will he fight these interests? Have the guts to do so? It's been a slightly timid performance so far.
Mm-hmm. Why is that?
Well, I think first of all, I find it hilarious that people on the right and CEOs are constantly complaining about him being this anti-business president. I think that for whatever reasons, and they may not be ideological, it may be his view of the best way to not get in the way of the recovery. I don't know, but the SEC's enforcement has been very indulgent, and also the actual numbers show, studies been done that show that in terms of introducing, improving new regulations by federal regulatory agencies, the Obama administration at this point has not approved as many as the Bush administration did in the same time frame. Why? I don't know. I think some of it at the beginning reflects the business, the quite pro-business cast of his original economic team. Larry Summers now gone, obviously, and Timothy Geithner and others. It's begun to change a bit. We'll see if it keeps changing more.
Frank Rich is our guest. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-486-8655. Lines are open. I'm still looking for somebody who's seen Veep on Sunday. Somebody out there has seen the show. We'd like to hear your thoughts about it. And give us your review. Our email is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, but we're covering a lot of territory this hour as well. Let's spend a few moments, Frank, on the Supreme Court, looking at immigration in Arizona yesterday and looking at health care. Are we, and what it comes down to is, what are the judges thinking? Is it going to be another 5-4, et cetera? I'd like to hear your comments on both of these really substantial cases.
Well, they are substantial cases, and perhaps unsurprisingly, I don't think there's a constitutional basis for throwing out the health care mandate, and I do think that there are parts of the Arizona law, if not most of it, that infringe on people's constitutional rights. That said, I think it's a fool's errand to predict what the court is going to do on the basis of the questioning and everything. We just don't know. We'll have to see. I think that whatever happens will have some political impact, perhaps the immigration even more than the health care. I feel that the health care law, if they actually throw it out, could be a political wash, because I think a lot of people, now that some of these benefits are arriving from the Affordable Care Act, a lot of Americans are going to be angry if the thing is torn asunder, just as there'll be some who are applauding on the right because they think the law is some crazy power grab. The immigration, the Arizona immigration law, this is a law that was cited by the presumptive Republican presidential nominee is something that should be a model for the country. He's already trying to back away from that gingerly because, frankly, if Republicans lose most of the Hispanic vote, it's not clear that they have a shot at getting the presidency, and because it's very crucial in certain swing states that are in play. And yet, what if the court rules in favor of this law? Then Romney, I think that's it's bad for the country, but if you want to be cynical and look at it politically, I also think it's bad for Republicans, because they'll be blamed for it, and it will be conservative justices appointed by Republican presidents that will have acted in what many may think is a partisan way.
And back to health care for a moment, there has been some speculation that if the Supreme Court knocks it all down, there is a possibility that the next thing on the table would be, da-da, lo and behold, a public option. Is that crazy thinking?
I don't know if it is or not, but it well might be, and I'm not sure my expertise is advanced enough to judge whether really this could happen. Politically, my guess is yes, but not tomorrow. You know, then there'd be a whole other drag out fight that would probably drag in through another administration or two. I think what'll happen is the whole issue of healthcare, always incredibly fraught politically on both sides anyway, will become even more of a third rail that no one will want to go near, and we will continue to stew in this current costly, unwieldy, often frightening healthcare system that we have.
Patrick in Madison, hi. Patrick, are you there? Well, I don't know what happened to Patrick, but he wanted to give you a compliment and say he loved Veep and thought it was a very witty show.
That's terrific.
Who
Thank
writes?
You, Patrick, wherever you are.
Is there a big staff of writers on the show, Frank?
There's a fairly substantial staff. Armando Iannucci and his longtime writing partner, Simon Blackwell, are the two main writers. But there are five or six other writers on the show who are sort of a who's who of BBC and film comedy in England. A lot of them have worked for with Iannucci before on his hit BBC show that can be seen on BBC America, The Thick of It, which is still running. Some of them have worked for Sacha Baron Cohen. They're all these hilarious American political junkies. And like they all read Robert Caro, you know, they're all waiting for the new Johnson volume as much as we are.
Right.
And but they have this wonderful sort of skew perspective from a distance, which makes, I think, really helps make the show funnier. And they're delightful, the delightful group of people that I've gotten to know over the 20 months I've been working on this. And we're hoping there's going to be a second season and everyone will be back.
Yeah. And I think Patrick is with us now. Hi, Patrick.
Oh, hi there, Kathleen. Great. I'm on a cell phone and kind of losing you. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. I love the show. It was just outrageously funny. And I love that most of the humor was not obvious humor.
I'm thrilled. Well, we wanted
perhaps that's the British wit in play there. I also thought, and you can correct me if I'm off here, but I also thought there was a slight hint of, this is what it would be like if a Sarah Palin-type character actually was elected.
On that, I think you are off. We did not want to make a character who resembled Palin or Hillary Clinton or any known politician, because we thought it would be boring. It's been done before. It's been done well. And I don't think it's really true of Selena. She is, there's so many, she can have her moments of being lost and stymied, but, you know, she's her big initiative is a green jobs commission and clean jobs. She's sophisticated. She's not someone from a state like Alaska. She's an urban person. She's upper middle class. The character is actually sort of somewhat wealthy, as will become clear in other episodes. She's a divorcee with a daughter who's in college. A lot of this isn't clear in obviously just one episode. And she's a real creature of Washington, which certainly Sarah Palin is not. She's never spent really a minute in Washington. And so I don't think so. I think you know, there's a tendency, because if it's any woman that's portrayed in politics on screen is automatically, it seems, has to be some clone of Hillary or Palin, but it really isn't the case. And it's hard to imagine Selena Meyer picking up a rifle. It's hard to imagine her being out fishing. In fact, we do one thing that's an extra of the show that'll turn up online, where she's trying to be involved in a public service thing involving water and clean, you know, clean water and clean fishing, I guess you call it, and she doesn't even know what she's talking about any more than I do. So it's a very different character. But in terms of the wit, I think these are just really, really good writers, and they wanted to. And the one good thing about HBO is, besides letting them use four-letter words, which there are several,
yes, there are
in this show, many of them spoken by Julie Louis-Dreyfus, HBO gives them the freedom to have their own vision, and so it doesn't have to be dumbed down or homogenized in the way that sometimes happens on broadcast television, cable, without answer. Not having to answer sponsors and not really having to answer ratings gives you a freedom, and that's why a lot of shows in HBO, and not just HBO, but other cable, you know, Breaking Bad, other show, Homeland, have a sophistication that you can't often find on, can't always find on broadcast television.
How does a British guy, how does Iannucci get a lot of the American politics so right? Is he a keen observer of America?
He's a very keen observer. He's a junkie. He's reading the same blogs and everything that the rest of us are. And one of the problems we've had in this, it's not a problem, but one of the weird things is there's been we've had things in the show that turn out to be real events, then duplicate them. You know, this show's been in the can for quite a while. We finished shooting last fall, but we have a Secret Service incident later in the season.
Oh.
It does not involve sex scandal, but there was this whole Marco Rubio flap where it turned out, as we, you know, he sort of falsified or misrepresented his parents' chronology in coming from Cuba to America when before he was born, I guess, we have an Asian American politician who turns up in Veep, whose story is similarly challenged. It's complete coincidence because it was written and shot before any of that happened. So that's how on top of it Iannucci and the other writers are, and we're constantly, you know, exchanging emails back and forth. And can you believe it? In the pilot, there's a whole as you know, Kathleen, there's a whole plot involving the institution of cornstarch, utensils, eating utensils, and the politicization of them. After we shot that pilot, which was last March, like a week later, there was a front page story in the Washington Post that, cornstarch utensils were being banned at certain Washington agencies because there was a political fight about it. I mean, who could make this stuff up? Well, we do, and then it turns out
it's real.
It's really funny.
We have a clip on that, actually. We'll play that, and then we'll welcome more phone calls. Frank Rich is our guest. This is a clip on the plastics thing that Frank was describing from Veep.
Senator Hallows, she is so tight with the plastics people. It's...
Are you kidding?
Yep.
Do these not bend back?
No.
What am I supposed to do with this? I'm supposed to eat around corners? Is that how it's going to work? Here, take this, please.
Okay. We could even give Hallows a post on your Clean Jobs Commission, Keep Plastics Happy.
That's actually a great idea. Can you do that? Can you get Hallows now?
Of course I can.
Okay.
Can you just shut it down?
Yeah. Go.
Okay.
You should mingle. You should... Just,
mingle?
Yeah.
What? How do you suggest that I mingle with this few people? Did Simon mingle with Garfunkel?
Well, they worked together. They probably socialized together. I'm sure they did, right?
We should explain for those who can't see it, besides the obviously bleeped out word there, one of these much-prized cornstarch substitution for plastic utensils, Selena, Julia Dreyfus, sticks in a cup of coffee and immediately wilts and bends. And the people, and when she has to mingle, like, you know, did Simon mingle with Garfunkel? That's because she's turned out up at what's supposed to be a big reception with 50 or 60 people on the Hill. And it turns out there are like 6 people there because the oil industry doesn't want anyone near her because she's got cooties because of her involvement with cornstarch utensils.
Frank Rich is our guest this hour. We're talking about many subjects with Frank. He, among other responsibilities and interests, he is executive producer of the new HBO comedy series Veep, which is on Sundays on HBO, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus, and it follows the day-to-day existence of former Senator, now Vice President, Selina Meyer. A very funny show. And Frank also, well, you know Frank, he is with New York Magazine now, where he's been for about a year, and he writes about lots of important issues. And he has agreed. He wrote Ghostlight, a memoir, which I hate to admit I've never read. I should have read that book. And so we're going to get that book, and Frank will talk with us sometime in the future about his memoir, even though it's a little old, and we can add some 10 years to his memoir, but growing up in Washington. Yeah, that'll be good. So if you want to join the conversation, feel free to do so. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, we got all this stuff going on, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And for those of you keenly interested in politics, which is the whole audience, I would imagine, you may want to do this on Friday evening, May 4, on the Ideas Network. The 4 Democratic candidates who are running for governor in the recall election will debate each other on the issues and also answer citizen questions from around the state. If you want to be a part of the studio audience, it is based in Madison, but we have a lot of people in the area. This would be an interesting thing to do, right? It's quite historic. It's the evening of May 4th at 7 o'clock, and here's a number for you to call so you can be in the audience. 800-253-1158. It's 800-253-1158. And the seating, of course, would be limited for an event like this, so please call early. The special will be broadcast on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio and also Wisconsin Public Television, Friday, May 4th at 7 p.m. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, Selena. Hey. Just a small change in the speech.
What is that?
Plastics apparently talked to the president. White House doesn't want us mentioning oil or cornstarch or plastics. Just wing it.
This has been penciled completely?
Yes, front and back. Very little romance.
That's the entire speech, okay? I mean, what's left here? I've got hello, and I have prepositions.
Well, I think you could talk about your boat or something like that.
Sure, talk about the boat.
Gary, seriously, can you just shut up for 2 seconds?
See, okay, now I can't read what you're writing.
Selena, relax. You're really good at Senate vote reform. Hit that one. That's a home run. That's your Sergeant Pepper's. We can also use my kitten heels gag.
All right, is that funny?
No.
It's funny enough for these people.
You hit the verbs.
You have some good pinches.
I've got it.
You got it? It's fine. Okay. I can do it. I can't. I don't know what that is.
Please welcome Vice President Selena Meyer.
Just prepositions from the show Veep. It's on HBO. Frank Rich, executive producer. He is our guest this hour. And we go to Dee in Waukesha. Hi, Dee.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. And
sure.
Thanks to your guest as well. It's been really entertaining listening and interesting. I got a chance to see the show. I love it. Thank you. I couldn't have picked a better actress than Julia Louis-Dreyfus to play that role. The humor's kind of, for me, was a chuckle that lasted all the way through the entire episode. So I just wanted to say that. And then I do have a question, and it's just a little bit probably broad, but you seem to be covering a lot of territory today, so I hope it's okay.
It is.
But I'm wondering if Mr. Rich could comment on the change in discourse, even among neighbors. My husband and I were just talking last night about how you can't, it's almost like talking about religion and how much you get paid at work to meet somebody, and you just don't want to say what sort of political affiliation you have because you know you're going to sort of have to gird up for war. And it just seems like the entire discourse has changed pretty drastically since the 2008 elections. Thank you for your time. I'm going to listen off air.
Thanks, Dee.
Very interesting. Thanks, by the way, about Veep. I guess this is true. I also think it may depend a little bit on who your neighbors are and what neighborhood you're living in. But I do think, and I don't think this is also unheard of in American history, we have, of course, more vehicles for angry communication that are public than we used to. But I do think that the Obama election stirred up a lot of passion. It was an historic election, and not all the passion obviously involves race, but I think leaving race out of it, it's generational change. He is an interesting figure, not cut from the same mold as most American presidents we've seen. I dare say the same thing might have been the case too if Hillary Clinton had won for other reasons. But he really is a break with the past, and I think a lot of people are threatened by it, angry about it. It's polarized a lot of people. I think he's actually a very mild guy, not really a polarizing figure. He's almost a moderate to a fault at times, in my view. But people are really angry. I think the other thing that's a piece of it that has nothing to do with any specific politician is the economy. This was the worst, and still for many people is, the worst downturn since the Great Depression that very few people who were alive lived through or remember. And so people are furious, and they're furious on the right and left, often for overlapping reasons, as many have said, including me, whether it's the Tea Party or Occupy Wall Street and its offshoots. People feel the system is stacked. They feel they're getting the short end of the stick. They feel correctly that there's an inequality that pits the very rich against everyone else. So there are a lot of things for people to be angry about, and it can certainly filter down to daily political discourse with neighbors. Because I think while many people agree about what the problem is, a lot of people blame different sets of culprits. Some blame government, some blame Wall Street, some blame specific politicians and political parties. But the one thing that may relieve this, frankly, is real recovery that holds, and B, some reform that will address this inequality that's choking the system and has been for 40 years.
Plus, Frank, Dee is living in Wisconsin, and as you well know,
we
got a whole other set of issues going on in this state.
I know, and a big election coming up in June.
Yeah. Let's go to Jeannie, I think, in Mazamani. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm
sure.
A big fan of the show and Mr. Rich.
Thank you.
I just wanted to put in a plug for the movie, Iannucci's movie, In the Loop.
Great.
Which is one of the funniest movies I've ever seen. I've purchased several copies. I've made people watch it. I've laughed till I've actually hurt myself. And it's, you know, about British, well, Mr. Rich can address this, but it's about British politics and American politicians and their relationship. And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks
so much.
Jeannie.
Well, this is a movie I discussed earlier, and I couldn't agree more. It's about the run-up to the war in Iraq, even though it never mentions the war in Iraq. It was nominated for a screenplay Oscar for Armando Iannucci and his other writers. And in some ways, it gave birth to Veep, because we saw in it, people at HBO saw in it that hey, this guy, we knew he was a brilliant satirist of British government and politics through his hit series, The Thick of It, also hilarious. And here he was just tackling America just as well and brilliantly. And it's very much the tone of Veep. It's a feature film, and it's very available on, you know, Netflix or any place else. And it actually shares one actor with Veep, Anna Shlumsky, who plays the chief of staff to Julia Louis-Dreyfus's character in Veep, plays a not dissimilar role, but in the State Department to a fairly well in the Loop. So if you like Veep, or even if you haven't seen Veep, check out In the Loop. I think I completely agree with the listener.
All right, I'll do that. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
It was a great hour, and I'll look forward to talking to you about your life in Washington down the road.
That's very sweet of you. Yeah. Thanks. Meanwhile, take care of yourself, and thanks for having me.
Thanks. On. Frank Rich, our guest. He is, among many other things, one of the executive producers of Veep. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this show, and thanks to Rhonda for on-air production in our studios in Milwaukee. More coming up.